You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education podcast. I am your host, Sarah Custer. On this episode, we're talking about the legacy of empire and how universities are responding to its lingering presence in higher education. Indeed, decolonization is a sticky and complex topic that has become a lightning rod for critics who accuse universities and colleges of being full of liberal ideologues, with a number of pundits up in arms about efforts to decolonize reading lists and the curriculum. Notable recent headlines have labeled it a decolonization rot in higher education and a campus wokery march. But for some scholars, decolonization is merely a byproduct of the work that they do. People like my guest Farish Noor, a political historian of Southeast Asia, or Uju Anya, the Carnegie Mellon linguist whose own family was a victim of colonialism in Nigeria, who posted that tweet when the Queen died that drew criticism from Jeff Bezos to Piers Morgan. Carnegie Mellon condemned Anya's tweet, by the way, but she still has a job. Decolonization is a treacherous course to chart, but as Farish Noor says, it's absolutely essential to a comprehensive view of humanity. There is, however, a danger that decolonization works within old colonial boundaries and that it doesn't extend to scholars in the developing world. And many in academia still question its relevance for STEM subjects. But later in this episode, we'll hear from a mathematician who has overseen the creation of a database of original sources to give students that global historical view of the discipline. First up, here's my conversation with Farish Noor. Farish, thank you so much for joining us on the Times Higher Education podcast today. Tell us a little bit about who you are and what your academic background is.
Well, at the moment, I'm professor at the SDAC Standards of Decision Making Across Cultures master's program at Friedrich Alexander University in Erlangen. And I was a professor of history at the Department of History, University Malaya. And I suppose you could say I'm a political historian focusing on Southeast Asia, and my particular area of interest is the language and discourses of colonialism in 19th century Southeast Asia. And that's what I've really been working on over the past 15 years. But having said that, my background is actually in philosophy and literature.
So you're one of these people that lives in one country and works kind of on the other side of the world in Germany and really in your own work exists in this cross-cultural, cross-disciplinary academic world.
I suppose so, but I think that's true of many of us in academia today, owing to the fact that academia has become so globalized. And of course, you know, whether we like it or not, COVID has made life very complicated for many of us. But the communicative architecture that we have, you know, social media and recordings like this, actually makes it actually very easy for us to continue our work wherever we might be.
We should probably add now that we are having this conversation from our respective homes and you have some work happening in one of the apartments above you. So apologies to the listeners if they hear any drilling from Farish's side.
Yes, my sincere apologies. I assure you I'm not the one doing the drilling, but it's my neighbor upstairs.
That would be quite impressive if you were able to record a podcast while drilling. So Farish, decolonization efforts, it's not necessarily something new. This is part of scholarly work for a lot of people for a number of decades, but there seemed to be a bit of some velocity behind this and a bit of rallying behind the efforts of decolonization. Would you say that the work that you're doing in terms of teaching post-colonial history in Southeast Asia specifically, is that part of this movement, or is there something different that you see that you're doing?
Well, I think point out, you know, that I'm fundamentally a historian, and The debate is still going on as to what decolonization is and what it constitutes. And I suppose, you know, there are those who think that decolonization is a process, while others might say that, you know, decolonization is the end result. It's the goal, the intended goal. And I'm not sure where I personally stand when it comes to that. My work, I think, has the effect, the outcome of having a kind of decolonizing potential by virtue of the fact that I am particularly interested in the language of empire. That's what I do. My last few books were really books about books. I study the language of colonial capitalism as it was performed regulated and then put into place in the colonies, the respective Western colonies of Southeast Asia. And in the course of doing so, of course, you know, I'm trying to unearth things, the blind spots of history, if you like, the way in which, you know, categories and identities were being constructed through the process of colonization. And of course, while doing that, we also uncover other alternative parallel histories that have either been marginalized or erased or forgotten. And of course, that is part and parcel of what, you know, we are trying to do when we decolonize education. But, you know, I'm not a professional decolonizer. I'm a historian. You know, so what I do is history. And I think...
Can you just give us an example, Farish, of what you mean by the language? Is there...
A very simple example would be the very concept of Southeast Asia itself, right? I mean, I am a historian of colonial Southeast Asia, 18th and 19th century Southeast Asia, but it has to be remembered that the very idea, the notion of Southeast Asia itself, the signifier Southeast Asia, is not a Southeast Asian invention. I mean, Southeast Asians in the pre-colonial period presumably did not think of themselves as being southeast of anyone. As far as they were concerned, they were the center of the world. The same goes for anyone, in Africa, Europe, South America, what have you. So where did we get these vocabularies? Where did we get these geographical coordinates? And these are political coordinates that were imposed on the peoples of the world as a result of the colonial encounter, whether we like it or not. So in the process of doing that, I mean, I'm very interested in mapping, for instance. I mean, maps for me are documents of power. And I teach also about colonial mapping and data gathering. And that's where we find, you know, these other forgotten vocabularies and epistemologies. I mean, Southeast Asians, for instance, would refer to the region as Nusantara or Suvarnabhumi. And yet, you will know, post 1950s, especially with the creation of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN, the word Southeast Asia is already part and parcel of our vocabulary. So, like it or not, things like Southeast Asia, concepts like the nation state, are now part and parcel of the language of contemporary politics and governance in Southeast Asia. Okay. And that's part of the colonial legacy. And I think my job as a historian is to remind people of the etymology and the genealogy of these terms.
So it sounds like what you're saying within the higher education realm, within the campaigns for decolonization or the exploration of what decolonization is, it sounds like what you're saying is you are kind of an accidental decolonizer, or just by virtue of the type of work that you're doing, it is decolonization, but not necessarily intentionally and not necessarily in the same way that other efforts might be happening in other institutions.
Well, intentionally, to the extent that I think that good history has to be comprehensive. In other words, you know, the historian's job, for me at least, I mean, this is a completely personal opinion, by the way, I'm not imposing this on anyone else, but as far as I'm concerned, my job is to seek out as many narratives and histories that there are out there. And if I do a thorough job, then yes, by default, what happens is that we see that history is a complex thing. You know, nobody believes in linear history anymore anyway. Nobody believes in a unitary or singular history. But of course, one of the results of this is decolonization, where you actually unearth, you know, the voices and the histories of communities that have been swept under the carpet. But This is also what happens when you do proper comprehensive history. For example, the recovery of the history of women, the role of women as historical agents. That is part and parcel. You can't write a history of, say, the Second World War without talking about the role of women in the Second World War and how it changed their lives, right? Mm. So that's a comprehensive history. By default, it also becomes feminist history. But that's good history as far as I'm concerned. Mm. And I think there's nothing wrong with that.
Even still, though, you have voiced some opinions about the decolonization efforts that happen in Western institutions. And you've written a few pieces for campus talking about that. And in one of those pieces, you said that decolonization efforts in Western universities need to be accompanied by an equally serious effort to address the power and economic differentials that exist in the world today. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, this is, what I would like to see is a commitment to the idea that academic work is a global enterprise. I can't do my work without my colleagues in Indonesia, Singapore, Philippines, Japan, Germany, Britain, and what have you. We are part of the same academic community. But of course, ours, unfortunately, is not an equal community. So when we talk about decolonization, it's fine. There's nothing wrong with the decolonization effort that we see in disciplines like history and anthropology and sociology in Western universities. However, how much of this is available and shared with fellow scholars and fellow students from other parts of the world? I mean, a simple thing. It is exorbitant for a student from a third world country these days to even get into a university in the developed world. And apart from that, there are visa restrictions, there are monetary restrictions, there are passport restrictions and what have you. And then there are people in our part of the world, unfortunately, who do not even have citizenship, for heaven's sakes. So how are they going to be part of this decolonizing effort? And so I think universities don't exist in a vacuum. We are part of, you know, the political economy, and the political economy of our respective countries is part of a global system. We need to address that. So things like access to journals and the availability of opportunities for academics and students from developing countries to contribute to the debates that are taking place in Europe, how hard it is for many good academics, good scholars from the developing South to even gain access to get themselves published. And these are things that I think we need to address as well, because, I mean, I'm lucky in the sense that thus far, you know, my career has been a somewhat international one. But I mean, truly, that's a matter of luck. Yeah, I mean, I know many excellent scholars in Southeast Asia who have been writing very, very good stuff. But unfortunately, they are writing in their respective national languages. And whether we like it or not, the international language of academia today is English. That in itself poses a problem for a lot of scholars who may live and work in the non-English speaking world. So these are issues that I think we need to tackle together as well.
Hmm. It's interesting that you bring up the cost of studying in the developed world for students. And as you'll know, universities rely a lot on international student fees. That's a big part of the revenue that institutions have, and it's something that supplements research at many institutions. Would you go as far to say that it's hypocritical for institutions to have these decolonization efforts, but then, on the other hand, charge double tuition fees for international students to come study on their campuses?
Well, I think it's more than double, to be honest. I mean, in some cases, it's triple or quadruple. And yes, of course, I mean, I'm not sure whether the word hypocrisy applies here, but I mean, just look at the stark reality. You're talking about good scholars, good students who have ideas and who want to share them and who want to actually study in other parts of the world to broaden their horizons. But then when you're lumbered with air tickets and accommodation fees that amount to, you know, a year's salary for their parents or more, then, I mean, what opportunities are we talking about? It reminds me of kids are sometimes given this toy. You've seen babies playing with it. It's this box, an empty box that has these holes. And one hole is round, another hole is square, another hole is a triangle. And the objective is to put these shapes into the box. So you put a sphere, you put a cube, you put a pyramid into the box, the hole is always open, but you can only come in when you fit in. And so likewise, I think this is the irony. We are living in a world now where, of course, Western universities are there. They're open. They're open. You can't come in. You can't come in if you simply can't afford the prices. And let's be honest, for billions of people in the world, a university education in the West is a luxury that most people can't afford. And here we're talking about developing countries. What about those who live in war zones, refugees and what have you? I mean, that's a pipe dream.
You'll know that there are plenty of critics of decolonization, and some of them have called it even ideological. The acting VC of Cambridge, Anthony Freeling, said last year that he's baffled by it. Do you think there is sufficient critical discussion around how decolonization is being done and for what reason?
Well, I think here we need to also understand that, you know, decolonization takes place at different paces, different rates in different parts of the world according to different contexts. And I think, as I don't live and work in the United States, you know, I won't talk too much about that. However, it does, one does get the impression that there it's very much wrapped up in, you know, the kind of identity politics that's being, you know, articulated and then contested in North America. Mm-hmm. And that's very different from the kind of decolonization efforts that we get in, say, other parts of the world, in Africa or Asia. And that too also has problems. I think in any effort like this, you know, is bound to open up, you know, points of debate, which I think are valid and they need to be discussed. I mean, my concern when I look at some, not all, but some efforts at decolonization in the post-colonial South is that in some instances, decolonization is also accompanied by a kind of ethno-nationalist nostalgia where then we just end up repeating the old binaries, but we reverse them. So in the past, you know, the West is good and Asia is bad, but now Asia is good and the West is bad. And my worry about that is that that very quickly gets, if you like, you know, appropriated by political interests or ideological interests that want to further certain forms of nostalgia-based ethno-nationalist identity politics. And we've seen that happen. That can happen. But having said that, I think, you know, when you look at the backlash in Europe, I mean, for heaven's sakes, empire is empire. It has to be discussed. It has to be discussed. There is absolutely no way that I think you can talk about, the Western world today, Western Europe today, without discussing the legacy of empire. And that lingering legacy of empire, I know, is evident in even things like the COVID crisis, where Western nations were more than able to procure vaccines, for example, while many third world countries were left waiting for vaccines. And that wealth is the result of imperialism and colonialism. There is no way you can avoid that subject. So I think here we need to break down the debate and situate the debates in their respective countries. You know, the erasure or the forgetting of empire in the West, you know, is one way to reactivate, you know, certain kinds of, you know, politics of nostalgia in countries like Britain at the moment, whereas in the colonized world, post-colonial world, the remembrance of empire is also a way to reactivate certain forms of nostalgic politics for, you know, the kind of glorious golden age before the white people came, which I think is also problematic. So, I mean, that's why I think decolonization is actually a very interesting thing to talk about, because it's not a homogenous, it's not a flat phenomenon. Mm. It manifests itself in so many different ways. And I think it's really good for us to have a very global, a truly international debate about what it is and where it's heading. And also the ways in which it can be used to both emancipate, but also, you know, in some cases, suppress and marginalize and erase.
When you were talking about reestablishing those binaries, but just kind of flipping them on their heads, would you say that there is a tendency to project some sort of value or moral stance on those binaries, and that perhaps is problematic or not so much helpful, and that maybe a more of an objective view? I mean, you said empire exists, we have to talk about it, but perhaps taking more of an objective view of exactly what that was and how that still permeates part of post-colonial culture and the colonizing culture?
No, I think it's hard to have a quote-unquote objective view of empire any more than I think one can have an objective view of apartheid. You know, I mean, apartheid is wrong, period. That's it, right? Mm-hmm. And even when the anti-apartheid struggle was going on, the purpose of it became an international debate. The purpose of it was to end apartheid, not to reform it. The objective was not to create a kind of apartheid light or, you know, diet apartheid or something. Apartheid is morally wrong, but it has a political economy, and it has, you know, a kind of, it has its, you know, global network of support. It has its diplomacy, and all of these things need to be critically assessed and discussed critically. I'm not sure whether we can ever have an objective discussion of empire, because it is something that necessarily invites, you know, moral analysis as well. What I'm worried about is not, you know, the injection of ethics or moral discussion into a debate about empire. What I am concerned about is how discussions about empire can lead to attempts to either forget it, erase it, you know, sanitize it, or actually to use empire as a basis to launch another kind of, I know, a sort of anti-Western nationalist politics, which we see in many parts of the non-Western world today. And because, you know, remember, the messy thing about empire is that empires were built on collaboration. And this is what most people don't want to actually accept. Yeah, it is humanly impossible for a few thousand Europeans to colonize whole parts of the world without there being collaboration. Now, because of that, then discussions of empire and the mechanics of empire and human agency in empire become fraught with, you know, accusations and guilt and moral baggage. And I think that's why many people are very uncomfortable with it. But if we don't have this discussion, then the status quo remains, and we keep falling back. We fall back, we fall back, we fall back on a vocabulary that we have inherited from the 19th century. And this is an inheritance for all of us, yeah, the West and the East. We've inherited this vocabulary, but we haven't really interrogated this vocabulary. And how and why we use concepts like borders, nation states, you know, these regional blocks, you know, East Asia, West Asia. These are all part and parcel of the language of empire building. And so these words, I mean, this is not like describing oranges and apples. We're talking about geopolitical constructs, including, you know, understandings of ethnicity, identity, and what have you, that have their history in a historical process that was, you know, based on very real power differentials. And I think one can do this academically. One can do this in a thorough manner. And that's why, you know, economic historians in particular interest me, because a lot of their work, you know, looks at the actual figures, you know, how much was taken, how many people were exploited, you know, and these things at least, you know, keep us within the realm of, you know, data and numbers and facts. But even having said that, you know, I don't think we can ever reach a point where we are, in a sense, you know, in an amoral sense, objective when we talk about colonization and empire any more than we can talk, you know, about history in a completely disinterested way. And as someone from a literature background, you know, I mean, I can't talk about Jane Austen in a completely objective way. I don't know how to be objective about, you know, Conrad or any author for that matter.
Speaking of facts and figures, we've talked a lot about history, literature, sociology. How about decolonizing something like math or science, which is based on fact? I mean, there's scientific law, there's math law. That doesn't really change no matter what country you're in or what period you're in. Any thoughts in terms of how people go about decolonizing STEM subjects and if it's even really possible?
Well, I think this is an avenue that's worth looking at. I mean, intuitively, as you've said, right? We assume that the the principles and the formulas and the laws of mathematics are the same. I mean, there's always been that universal appeal, not only to mathematics, but also to physics and logic and the hard sciences. However, one thing it shares in common with things like history, for example, is not facts, but rather the ordering of facts. It's the ordering of facts that I find interesting. And this includes things like mathematics as well. If you look at, say, the ordering of facts in history, if you write a history that privileges a certain set of actors all the time, while marginalizing another group of actors all the time, see, for example, you know, you don't ever talk about the economic contribution of women to a national economy. Now, I think that ordering of facts is the thing that we are critiquing and we need to critique. Why is it that female agency, economic agency, is not given the same attention as male economic agency? And I think when it comes to mathematics and the hard sciences, the same might apply as well. I think in the domain of economics, economic history, which is somewhat in between, you know, social sciences, because again, it's very much oriented towards numbers. And we are looking at, I've read some very interesting work of late that compares, for example, recognized economic production. You know, this is economic production that suited or served the interests of, say, colonial companies, and native economic production that was never taken into account. So how many houses were built? How many sampans were built? How many prahus were built? Nobody took note of any of this because this was seen as native agency, and so these numbers don't matter. And I think it would be really fascinating to have a debate that is widened, where we bring in not only economists but mathematicians. I mean, you know, the ordering of numbers. What would be the relevant calculations that apply when we want to do a serious analysis of the long historical legacy of empire? So, I mean, I of course, you know, I'm not a mathematician, so I can't comment any further. But I have seen of late, over the last decade at least, you know, some very, very interesting work coming up in this area.
Final question for you, Farish. How would you like to see decolonization efforts evolved? I mean, we touched on this a little bit in terms of bringing in the real world differentials that exist between these two worlds. Any ideas of how things should go forward with this, or how perhaps current efforts should change or improve?
Well, I think for a start, I would really like to see, you know, this effort gain more traction internationally, but in a meaningful sense, where people from different parts of the world feel that they have something to contribute and that they can actually contribute. Now, one of the few good things about COVID is that it's actually made, you know, land-bound terrestrial travel, you know, not so important, because we can actually have entire conferences. I mean, I teach courses online internationally all the time. And I think we can move in that direction. But having said that, again, and again, this is a completely personal statement on my part, yeah, you know, I'm a historian. I mean, what I do is I study language. I study the language used, the discourses used during the era of empire that were used to justify the political economy of racialized colonial capitalism. I would love to be in, you know, engagement with other people in the social sciences and in the hard sciences, you know, to see how we can actually work together. But having said that, you know, like I said, you know, decolonization happens to be one of the, if you like, byproducts of what I do. What I really do is I study language. I look at how language is connected to power and how language can be instrumentalized in a very powerful way to yield certain intended political results, including empire building. Now, in the process of doing so, I also uncover stuff about languages and discourses and vocabularies that have been suppressed or forgotten deliberately through the process of colonization. And I think that's where, you know, the decolonization aspect of my work comes to the forefront. And I think there are many people who are doing something very similar. People who are, for instance, studying local sciences that developed in many parts of Asia. If you look, for instance, I have many colleagues working at traditional medicine in Asia. And the whole, I mean, they don't set out to say that, you know, this is the new paradigm or what have you. But in effect, what they're doing is they're showing, look, there are parallel histories. There are other histories as long, if not longer, that we should also take into account, because it's only by doing that that we have a comprehensive understanding of human history. And I think that's where I personally would like to see, you know, our efforts hit towards in the future.
Farish, thank you so much for your time. This has been a fascinating conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me too.
We'll now hear from Bridget Stenhouse, a lecturer in the history of mathematics in the School of Mathematics and Statistics at the Open University. She spoke with my colleague Miranda Prynne about a project she led to create an interactive online database of original sources selected to demonstrate the global nature of mathematics. Original sources such as letters, calculation aids, and clay tablets enable students to see beyond the final calculations to the work that went into uncovering their results in the first place.
Hi, Bridget. Thanks so much for joining us on the podcast today. Now, you've been involved in a really interesting project aimed at opening up global perspectives on mathematics, which we will come to talk about. But first, I'm really keen to know, what is your response to people who say that decolonization is not relevant or necessary in the context of maths, and indeed other, in inverted commas, objective STEM subjects?
My first response would be to ask them what they mean by decolonization and see if their description matches my own. Just because discussions around decolonizing the curriculum can be somewhat polarizing, even though this phrase is used to mean different things by different people, and not least, it's often conflated with equality, diversity, and inclusion work. And I hope through this podcast, it'll become clear that actually mathematics and mathematicians have played a role in both enforcing and disrupting colonial rule, settler colonialism, and also why I think this is important to sort of discuss with students. I tried to follow the interpretation of decolonizing given by the 2019 Open University Innovating Pedagogy Report. This says that decolonizing learning is about considering multiple perspectives and making space to think carefully about what we value. Decolonizing learning helps us to recognize, understand, and challenge the ways in which our world is shaped by colonialism. It also prompts us to examine our professional practices. It's an approach that includes Indigenous knowledge and ways of learning, enabling students to explore themselves and their values and to define success on their own terms. Specifically in mathematics, I would say for thousands of years, mathematicians have valued having multiple methods and tools for understanding and solving the same problem. Sometimes you might complete the square to solve a quadratic equation, and others you might use the quadratic formula. Arguably, colonialist attitudes to non-European ways of thinking have artificially limited this multiplicity of mathematical practice, and continues to do so now. It just makes sense to me to be open to as many ways of treating mathematical problems as possible. I would also point out that mathematical research is contingent on so many factors that ground it in society, even if the work itself can be incredibly abstract. There are still gendered and racial barriers that affect access to mathematical education, jobs, research grants, and other resources. If we are to tear down these barriers, it helps to know how they are built and maintained. And colonialism certainly informs and shapes racial and gendered hierarchies in society.
Yeah, brilliant. So, I mean, it's not just about the solutions to mathematical problems. This is about the whole context in which the subject functions.
Yeah, exactly. Like, mathematics doesn't exist in a vacuum. There's no point coming up with a new theorem if there's not a community that you can turn to and say, hey, I have this new mathematical idea. Let's see what we can do with it. Let's see what it can do for us. And that kind of aspect, maths is done by humans. For the most part, it is also done by computers, but those are built by humans. So it's very important to kind of understand that interaction. And part of that is obviously relevant to decolonizing.
Yeah, of course. And that is the same point. The point that math is done by humans and computers built by humans applies to all subjects. So that argument, you know, is a broader one as well. It goes beyond math to all STEM subjects and further. When considering how to actually go about decolonizing maths, what would be the key points that you would highlight to someone who wants to do this, who wants to take action here?
I think the first thing I would say, specifically as regarding decolonizing the curriculum, this cannot be just an optional extra on a course. I think it's really important that universities invest in staff time and resource to ensure that this decolonizing work is actually embedded into course materials, learning, assessment. I don't think this is in any way separate from providing a fit for purpose mathematical education. So, for example, these students that we're teaching, we can't just give them the mathematical skills and say, and like send them off into the world. As an undergraduate, I was expected to give an oral presentation about something to do with mathematics. I happened to choose to do it about Eminetta. But the key thing was, it didn't matter what we were talking about. It mattered that we were getting up in front of a room of other people and making an argument, sharing some new information, and then taking questions. These are all the kinds of skills that mathematicians need. And these mathematicians will also be the people who sit on grant committees or hiring panels, and they need the skills to be able to deduce, okay, what do we think is worth funding? What do we think is worth supporting? And part of that is being aware of perhaps prejudices or even colonial mindsets, if you will, that affect how you value these applications that you might be assessing. And so in the same way as sort of giving a presentation is a vital skill that our students should leave with, this awareness of mathematics and its intersection with society, I think, is also a vital skill to have, whether you stay in academia or whether you take a job elsewhere. Oh, and I also wanted to add that decolonizing mathematics isn't just about the content that we teach. It's also about the ways in which we build our own research communities. So during COVID, when conferences moved online, there were lots of very important discussions about how this affected access to conferences, which I think it's important to continue. It's completely atrocious that scholars, especially scholars from the global south, continue to be denied access to conferences in the UK because they can't get a visa in time or at all. And so this decolonizing work isn't just decolonizing the curriculum. There's also ways we can decolonize our own mathematical practice and the way that we build our own research community.
Yeah, it's a very good point. That is opening up these kind of boundaries that have created barriers to certain people in certain parts of the world has got to be a key part of it. So you say there, a lot of it is awareness raising around each of us as individuals, improving our awareness of the structures that we've kind of become normalized to, I suppose, and being able to actually challenge them. And again, that is important across all disciplines because it goes beyond the kind of pure academic work to much wider behavioral issues as well. So can you tell me a bit about this interactive database of primary and secondary sources relating to mathematics and how it has come to be developed?
Yeah, so one thing to start with is to say that myself and my colleague on this project, Professor June Barrow-Green, we're both historians of mathematics, but we sit within the mathematics department at the Open University. This means that the teaching that we do is teaching of mathematics as well as some history of maths. But it also means that we kind of have direct communication with mathematics researchers and others who are teaching at university level. And I think, as you alluded to in a previous question or even your first question, there is a substantial amount of anxiety around decolonizing the curriculum. There are people who either don't think it's necessary, don't think it's part of the university education we should be giving, or people who just don't know how to do it, even if they think that it should be done. The history and lived reality of colonialism is a vast topic. that many mathematicians don't feel equipped to broach in a learning environment where they are used to being experts. As historians, we felt we could offer a bit of help to lecturers and students who want to open up discussions around decolonizing mathematics and what this can mean in a university setting. We felt the best way to do this, that we could with our expertise, would be to produce this database of primary sources, which gives direct access to the different ways in which mathematics has been practiced throughout history. To support teaching activities, these primary sources will be accompanied by short contextual summaries, a list of further reading suggestions, and some proposed discussion or essay topics. At the very least, this can provide a starting point for lecturers and will enable students who so wish to explore their own mathematical heritage.
So just to understand, so it is just primary sources, it's not actually primary and secondary sources, as I said there.
So the secondary sources come under the list of further reading suggestions.
Of course, okay, got it. And in terms of how you have selected this material, you know, sourced it, how have you gone about doing that in a way that sort of ensures a really global and diverse knowledge base and indeed supports this mission of decolonization?
The selection of materials is definitely the hardest part of putting together this database. It's very important to me that not only the primary sources are drawn from a global pool, but also that the secondary sources that we'll put in the further reading and that we draw on for the contextual summaries, that these reflect the wealth of knowledge being produced on decolonization by Indigenous communities and researchers in the Global South. One of the key ways we want this resource to be informed by decolonizing work is to ensure that we don't recreate previous hierarchies. For example, always presenting white Europeans as the typical or the most prestigious knowledge producers and othering anybody else. So we will be including as many primary sources as we can get our hands on. Some of this is limited by the kinds of things for which secondary materials are available. But yeah, just doing the best we can. And kind of another hierarchy that we don't want to recreate is things like Islamic mathematics was only important in the early modern period, and Greek mathematics was the only mathematics worth looking at in the ancient period. But trying to show the kind of mathematical practices that were happening in these different places throughout history, rather than just when we might typically look at those places. Another way the choice of materials supports the mission of decolonization is to demonstrate the roles taken by mathematicians in enforcing and disrupting colonial rule. For example, mathematicians were vital to the efforts to find ways of accurately navigating at sea, which was obviously necessary to exert military dominance on distant lands or to control the extraction and trade of goods. On the flip side, in the late 19th century, Dedabai Nairoji used his knowledge of statistics to demonstrate exploitation of India by the ruling British Empire at the time and advocate for a reimagining of how India was ruled. There are numerous other instances to be included where mathematical research, whether it started out as abstract or not, has had a real life impact. I really think having these discussions with students is vitally important, as they will have to make decisions themselves on how they use their own mathematical knowledge within academia or not. It's not about enforcing a moral viewpoint on students so much as making them aware that there are implications of the decisions that we make as mathematicians. Mathematics can be abstract, but mathematicians are still human and exist in society.
I'm really glad you gave some examples there, actually, of the sorts of past events or influences of maths that this can point to. I think that's really helpful. And as you say, what this can do is start a conversation and trigger reflection around how this subject can be applied. Maths has been happening all around the world throughout the ages, right?
Yeah.
And influencing societies, and will continue to do so. So it's a hugely important conversation.
Yeah, and I just think, I mean, sometimes you might hear a pure mathematician sort of saying, I mean, it can be difficult sometimes to justify funding for pure mathematics because it doesn't have these direct applications that people point to. But then pure mathematicians will be like, oh, but, you know, loads of things were really abstract first, and we didn't know what we were going to apply them to until later. And I feel like it's trying to have your cake and eat it at the same time of like, oh no, it's abstract now, but it might not be abstract later. But then as soon as you point out that there might be or there have been these real world applications, it's like, no, mathematics exists outside of society. Like, we don't need to worry about that. And it's kind of like bringing these two things together. I mean, personally, mathematics is fascinating, whether or not it has a direct application. And I fully support people doing research in pure mathematics and answering these questions, even if it's not gonna, be useful tomorrow, or like useful in a real world application tomorrow. But at the same time, I do think it is very important to be cognizant of how we use mathematics or how other people might use the mathematics that we develop.
Yeah, absolutely. The cutting edge of research, you're right, isn't necessarily going to have direct applications, but just instilling in students early the idea that knowledge carries with it kind of responsibility, in a sense, is always going to be a positive, just to start that, build that awareness early on. Thank you so much for talking to us today, Bridget. That's been absolutely fascinating. Hugely appreciate it. And do you have any timeline for when this might be launched at the moment?
Yes, we are hoping to have it ready by around January. Although the way that we're building it is, ideally, we'll be able to keep adding more primary sources to the database, and it'll be sort of quite a long running project that will hopefully keep growing for a while.
Great stuff. And is it going to be open access?
Ideally, it will eventually find its way to OpenLearn, which is open access. It's run by the OU. And in fact, there are already quite a few decolonizing the curriculum resources on there for lots of different subjects, not just mathematics.
Great. Well, there you go. Anyone listening, if you're interested, that's where to head. Thanks again for talking to us. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much.
That's it for this episode of the Times Higher Education Podcast. Thanks to Farish and Bridget for joining us. And we always like to hear from you. So if you've got any comments or questions about the podcast, you can get in touch with me at sarah.custer@timeshighereducation.com.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education Podcast.